Welcome to the podcast of the Geological Society. My name's Sarah Day and I'm with Caroline Smith, who is Head of Earth Sciences Collections and Principal Curator of Meteorites at the Natural History Museum, and Sarah Gordon, who is on the Geological Society's Council. And Sarah, you're actually one of Caroline's students during your PhD.
I was, many moons ago. Yes, I was one of Caroline's first students.
It was actually, yes, if I remember, it was pre your PhD. You did that summer project with me when you were still at Glasgow.
Yes.
And through that amazing experience, that's when you decided to do a PhD.
Yes, I did it with Phil Bland at Imperial College. So Caroline is the person who inspired me to study rocks from space in the first place. So it might be said that she's the reason why I'm here today.
That's nice. That's very nice. Thank you very much. I'm very touched. Oh, I'm going to start crying.
I was really interested from your talk that the study of meteorites is actually quite recent. And when people first found these rocks, everyone assumed that the stories of them flying from space were complete lies.
Yeah, it's one of those sort of unexpected things, and one of the reasons why I find meteorites so fascinating as objects. It's not just their scientific stories and the fact that they've got these amazing histories, you know, dating back to the very first stages of our solar system. It's that many of them, as individual objects, have got great histories associated with them about the circumstances of their fall or who recovered them or when they were recovered. But you're quite right. I mean, until the late 1700s, very early 1800s, meteorites were not seen as scientific objects of interest. At best, they were mere scientific curiosities. And so meteorites really is quite a young science, and that's, you know, it's quite nice to be involved in a young science because you think, oh, maybe there's going to be that big discovery that I might make and win a Nobel Prize. Now, I think the chances of me doing that is very slim. But it's a really, you know, it's such a diverse field using diverse techniques. Most people, but not all, but most people come from a geology background, but we have physicists who study meteorites, we have chemists who study meteorites, we have astrobiologists who study meteorites, we have geochemists who study meteorites. I mean, it really does, it's one of those fields, like geology, that really does touch on all of the sciences.
And obviously for a geologist, there's always places to discover and rocks to find, but for meteoritics, there's a very limited amount of material that you have to work with. Is there a limit on how much you can find from the meteorites that we have, or does it depend very much on the technology that's coming online?
Yeah, good question. I mean, one thing I would say is even in meteorites that have already been, let's say, extensively studied, there is always the chance you are going to find something new. And that could be because you are using, as you mentioned, a new technique or a new technology that means you can study that thing, you know, maybe it's that isotope system or that chemistry to a level that hasn't been able to be previous. But then again, you know, there are things in meteorites that people misidentify or they just simply miss because they're looking for something else. And I think that's one of the things that each meteorite is a unique object. It's like a little treasure trove of information in there, and you never know what you're going to find. Even in a sample, a thin section that's been studied extensively, you can find new minerals and things like that. I mean, you probably found that when you were doing your PhD, didn't you?
Yeah, certainly. So for my PhD, I studied probably one of the most studied meteorites called Allende, which fell to Earth in Mexico in 1969, just before we went to the moon. And so there were lots of laboratories ready on Earth to study space rock. And whilst quite a lot of this particular meteorite fell to Earth, so there's lots to study, what I did with my research was that I utilised different techniques from different disciplines so that we could analyse each single component to get that absolute chemical composition, which is something that nobody had been able to do before. And it's by getting this additional data and feeding it into the, say, very clever mathematicians, for example, who are there modelling what was going on with our solar system when it formed. From the geochemical aspect, we're giving them real data rather than theoretical data. And so that can really help us answer questions about our solar system and the universe as a whole. I think the other thing to add to that as well is that, yes, we've got tens of thousands of meteorites here on Earth that we've found, or we've seen fall to Earth, but there are more meteorites that land every day as well. So there are lots of collection expeditions that go to different parts of the Earth to find more rocks from space that we
can
analyze.
I'm imagining a sort of meteorite rush of scientists every time they hear tell of a new one falling. But how does that work? Who has the rights to to get their hands on it.
Ooh, that's a controversial subject. It's very country specific. So it very much depends on the laws of those countries. So, for example, Canada and some of the states of Australia have very stringent rules about meteorites being, you know, public property. You know, they're government property because they're seen as being such sort of valuable and important scientific and cultural and historical assets. Other countries don't have sort of national laws governing who owns meteorites. It will be very much based on, you know, belongs to who's ever land that it fell on. It does vary by country to country.
And obviously, while there's new meteorites falling every day, the thing that's one of the goals in this research is to be able to go to other planets or other bodies in space and collect samples so that we understand a bit more about where they come from. That's something which I think feels like sort of futuristic sci-fi science to most of us, but that's actually something that's on its way.
Yeah, well, it's already happened. I mean, we've had a number of solar system sample return missions. It's quite difficult to say, especially when you've had a few coffees and you've been talking all afternoon. But the first solar system sample return mission were the Apollo missions, which happened between 1969 and 1972. So we're actually coming up to the 50th anniversary of the first Apollo mission that landed on the moon and recovered material. That was Apollo 11 in July of 1969. And those missions recovered 382 kilograms of rock, which is huge. And I've had the great privilege of visiting the Johnson Space Centre on a number of occasions where the Apollo samples are curated, meteorites that are collected in Antarctica by the American scientific programmes are curated before they go to the Smithsonian for long-term curation. They curate Genesis solar wind samples, so atoms of solar wind that have been captured by the Genesis mission.
Air.
Well, it's atoms, particles, you know, sort of atomic particles of material from the sun. They collect, curate samples of cometary dust that were captured by the Stardust mission. They curate cosmic dust particles that are collected on big sticky bits of collector that very high atmospheric planes fly around and collect this cosmic dust. So they curate and study a vast array, and it really is incredible to go there and see these things. But to get back to your original point about, you know, well, we've got all this stuff, you know, how much new information. The Apollo samples, 382 kilograms of them, only a tiny amount has actually been studied. They have samples that have still, since they were, okay, it's been preliminary investigated, it's this type of rock, no one's studied it. And some of those have been deliberately kept aside in pristine form, so they are still in the original boxes that the astronauts brought back from the moon, so that we can try and minimise any potential changes that have happened in that curation process. They try and keep, you know, they keep the atmosphere as stable as possible, very clean environment in these glove boxes that they use, but to try and keep those as pristine. So in years going down, you know, in years' time, in going forward, we've got instrumentation that we couldn't even dream of now, with sensitivities of you know, orders of magnitude that we can get now. And so maybe those will be the times when we unlock those boxes.
I mean, so that was deliberate.
That was a deliberate decision to keep some of those samples back that have never been studied for scientists coming in the next decades to even centuries. And actually, I don't know whether I ever showed Sarah this in the museum. Did you ever see the iron meteorites and the things that look like light bulbs?
No.
So, I'm trying to think which keeper it was. One of the keepers in the 1800s, I think it could have been Story Maskelyne, put some iron meteorites in some glass tubes with different atmospheres, so argon, neon, nitrogen, different things, sealed them up and left them. And we've got a box of these things, and the idea was it's a long-term experiment. And but all of the curators down the line, everyone's like, oh, I don't want to be the one who opens it.
At some point, someone's got to open it.
But that's an experiment that's been going on. If it was a Story Maskelyne, I'll have to look back in the archives, and it's like something like 150, 180 years. So this is the sort of thing that we're dealing with. You know, we're always having to plan, not what we're going to do as scientists tomorrow or next year or in 10 years' time, but how we're going to make sure that we've got these amazing resources available for the scientists coming in generations to come.